It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
Can we be sure that Jesus really existed? Are the New Testament documents reliable? Do they really tell us about a historical figure named Jesus, Yeshua, who lived almost 2,000 years ago? Or is he just the creation of Christian church and popular myth and a conglomeration of other myths? Well, I know of no better person in the world to talk to about this than Professor Craig Keener. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire today. It is my true delight to have Dr. Keener on the broadcast with us. He is one of the world's foremost New Testament scholars, but better than that, a real lover of Jesus and a real friend. If you have a question you'd like to ask about the historical reliability of the Gospels and can we really know about this historical Jesus, the number to call is 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. You can email me at Dr. Brown, drbrown at askdrbrown.org. Craig, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today.
It's my privilege to be with you, Mike.
And Craig, when did you come to faith? What year was that?
1975.
And were you raised in the Lord? What was your upbringing?
I wasn't raised in a church at all. I was an atheist at least by the age of 9. And I thought I could explain the universe without recourse to the hypothesis of a god. So in other words, I was a nasty brat. Nobody would play with me.
But, really? Yeah.
I had some. My ideas were really messed up. I can see now. I mean, but God and His grace revealed Himself to me, and I became a Christian.
And how old were you at that time, Craig?
I was 15.
15 years old. Now my wife, Nancy, when I met her, she was 19, and she was a hardcore atheist when we met, and then God saved her. She said that she became an atheist by the time she was 8. So how many kids? I mean, this is not the most normal thing, and yet you were an atheist by the time you were 9? How come?
Well, I guess part of it was not a very smart reason. I thought that that's what smart people thought, you know, that you could explain the universe without appealing to God. And I think also, though, a major factor was that 80% of the people in the U.S. claimed to be Christian, and yet I couldn't tell by how most of them lived that it really made a difference in their lives. Mm. And I thought, you know, if they don't believe in Christianity enough to live like they believe it, then why would I want to believe in it?
Wow. You know what's amazing? When Nancy was just a young girl, her stepfather was a Reformed Jew. They went to synagogue, very liberal synagogue, and she saw no evidence of God in the family or in the synagogue and concluded that he couldn't be real. So it's just amazing what kids can see and notice. Now, when you came to the Lord, did you get interested in really studying the Scriptures early on?
Yes. I mean, the little children in Sunday school knew more about the Bible than I did.
Uh-huh.
So I figured, okay, I better start cramming. This is, you know, I've been looking for truth in physics or somewhere else, and of course there's some truth there, but the most important truth that I needed to find was the truth about God, and the best place to find that was in His Word. So I started, eventually I started reading 40 chapters a day, because if you do that, you can get through the New Testament once every week, or you can get through the Bible once every month.
So this. How old were you when this became your practice to read through the New Testament once a week or the whole Bible once a month?
I guess it was probably been 16 or 17.
16 or 17. So I just want to say this to our listeners: not everyone is going to either have the discipline or the gift to be able to do that. God help me. After I came out of drugs and was saved for about 6 months to memorize 20 verses a day, I understand. Not everyone can do that, but what I want to point out, friends, is if you're serious about Scripture, it's not a matter of waiting till you get to seminary or waiting till you have a certain educational opportunity. This is a matter of you and God and just saying, I'm going to get in the Word. So how long did you keep that up? That's extraordinary. Reading, do you have any idea how many times you've read through the New Testament?
No, I don't know. I didn't keep count.
But how long did you keep that habit up?
I was doing it at that time before I went off to Bible college, and I was also doing it some in Bible college.
So several years. Mm-hmm. And you went to Bible college, you studied with believers.
Yes.
But then after that, when you went on to grad school, you did not study with evangelical Christians throughout grad school. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. No, I went to Duke University, and the professors came from a variety of backgrounds.
All right, so were you exposed to some that were downright skeptical about the historicity of the Gospels, and does it really present a picture of a Jesus that is historically reliable? Did you run into a lot of skepticism or questions in grad school?
Now, keep in mind, not all the professors were this way, but I had one professor who said that any professor who publicly acknowledged faith in God should be fired. I had another professor who would never have said that, but the first day in my Gospels class, he argued that the Gospels were fiction.
Mm. And so you were not surrounded with every professor coming with a strong background of faith and trust in what was in the Scriptures. Did that throw you at all? Did it raise questions for you?
No, actually, you know, in a more evangelical setting, I had been reading the arguments from both sides, and I thought that there were a lot of weaknesses and the skeptical argument, but it was only when I was able to talk with the skeptics in person and dialogue with them that I was able to see, yes, there are weaknesses in the arguments, and they don't really have answers to some of the objections.
All right. In the next few minutes, can you just give me an idea of talking to some of these folks and why you felt that there were such weaknesses in the arguments? Because the way it's presented now, you still have that arrogance that's out there. Well, anyone who knows anything knows we can't really trust what's written in the New Testament. So you talked to people who were the skeptics, and you found in personal interaction that there were holes in their arguments.
Oh, definitely. Let me give a couple examples. One is an example where the professor, this is the one that I just mentioned, actually. First day of class, he said that the Gospels are ancient biographies. Ancient biographies were fictitious. Therefore, the Gospels were fictitious. So I approached him after class, and I said that it was my understanding that ancient biographies were basically historical works. And then I gave examples. I gave examples of Tacitus and Suetonius, who stuck very closely to their sources and wrote about recent characters, and then some like Plutarch and Livy, who wrote about characters of the distant past, and you know, there was more legend in that and so on. But I said essentially they were working with historical sources, and those writing about recent figures, like the Gospels, really stuck close to their sources. They're much more reliable. And after I finished this, my professor said, I don't know. I don't know anything about ancient biography.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Again, this is not all professors.
Right. But the idea, though, you get out of the Jesus seminar and then the way that's popularized in the media is that people who know what scholars have to say recognize that the Gospels are not reliable. A minute and a half before the break, give me, in your view, one of the strongest reasons that we can trust the New Testament witness.
Oh, boy, in 1 minute and a half?
Well, we'll just start. Just what right. The interest of our
all right. Well, let me follow up on the biography part. If we were dealing with a biography of any other ancient figure written this close to the time that the figure lived from the ancient world, scholars would be bending over backwards saying, wow, this is a remarkably useful source. We can know all sorts of history based on this source. The only reason I think that people don't do that with our Gospels is because they have an anti-canonical bias.
Mm. So if it's in Scripture, they have a bias against it, whereas if it was just some external secular document, they would say, wow, what an amazing source.
Right. If it were about the mission, if it were about Augustus or, you know, one of the Caesars, or about some ancient philosopher, we'd say, wow, we don't have a whole lot of biographies this close to the time the person lived. This one is pretty close.
All right. So, Craig, when we come back, I want to pursue that line of thought, because we often hear that the Gospels were written so long after the time of Jesus. They're not reliable. Friends, an amazing book I'm holding in my hands, 831 pages, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels by Craig Keener. Order a copy today. You will not be disappointed. Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown with my special guest, Professor Craig Keener, author most recently of The Historical Jesus of the Gospels. 866-34-TRUTH. If you've got a question on the reliability of the Gospels, can we really know if there was a historical Jesus? This is a great day to call. 866-34-TRUTH. Craig, before the break, I mentioned the common argument you hear from skeptics and critics that the gospel accounts are written, I mean, so late, a generation or two after the time of Jesus, that's so untrustworthy. We couldn't think of that today, and yet that's a totally misguided objection. Could you explain?
Yeah, it is totally misguided, because we have very few biographies from antiquity that are that early, that are within a generation or two. Usually we're depending on sources that are depending on other sources that go back further. And think of it, I mean, just even with common sense today, events that took place a generation ago, say 40 years ago, some of us are old enough to remember, actually, some of those, but for many who aren't, we know people who remember those events. If somebody came and told us that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't really assassinated or something else from that period, we're not going to just take what they say. We're not going to just accept that objection, because we know people who were around back then who have personal knowledge of those events.
And what about oral tradition in the ancient world? Things being passed on orally, was that different than in our culture today?
It was very different in terms of oral memory. There's one person was expressing different feats of memory. He talked about somebody who went to an auction all day and listened to all the prices for which everything was sold and the people to whom they were sold, and then at the end of the day, with no notes, repeated all that back from memory. Another person has said that he could meet 2,000 people in succession and then repeat back their names in reverse order, and so on. They trained their memories. Memory was essential in elementary education, in advanced education. Speakers would memorize speeches that would be a couple hours in length. That was a regular part of speaking training. Storytellers would memorize and repeat back stories that were a couple hours in length. Most important, most relevant is advanced education, because there we're thinking in terms of disciples. And disciples were people who knew very closely the teachings of their teacher, and their primary responsibility was to be able to pass those teachings on accurately. They didn't always have to agree with those teachings, but they'd better not misrepresent them.
Mm. So it would be in the ancient world, as far as accounts being passed on, the teachings of the teacher being passed on, that if I began to recite the alphabet to our listening audience and said A, B, R, X, Z, W, P, people would recognize, well, that's completely wrong.
Uh-huh.
Things would be that glaring in a culture where there was that much oral tradition being passed on. Is that correct?
Yes, it was very rigorous in terms of oral tradition.
And what about the way Luke starts his gospel? Does that give us a hint in terms of what he was trying to write and convey?
Exactly. Luke, in his preface, in his four verses, he gives us an outline of some of the material that he had available to him. In verse 1, he talks about how many have already written sources about Jesus by the time that Luke is writing. So there was a lot already in circulation written by the time he's writing. Also, in terms of oral, he says in verse 2 about those things that were passed down to us orally from the eyewitnesses. And so what we've just said about eyewitness tradition covers the period even before some of the things were written down. And again, we know they were written down very early. And then in verse 3, he talks about having thorough knowledge. And we know from Luke's second volume that he traveled to Judea and spent up to 2 years there, which would have given him plenty of time to check into what was happening. And then in verse 4, he appeals to the fact that he's just confirming what Theophilus already knew about these matters. So, you know, he's not making something up that, you know, like today you could make up something and nobody wouldn't have any eyewitnesses except for the risen Lord to tell you that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But in Luke's day, he was able to do something we can't do today. He was able to go back, talk with eyewitnesses, talk with people who knew the eyewitnesses, and thereby confirm the information that Theophilus already knew about.
Now, you've written a massive commentary in the Gospel of John, a very thorough commentary in the Gospel of Matthew. You've got a massive study on Acts coming out. You've got this 831-page book. And by the way, amazingly, it is written so clearly, the historical Jesus of the Gospels. Craig, I emailed you immediately when I got my copy from you that it's written so clearly, the massive documentation, but any serious student can follow this. But you've immersed yourself in the Gospels far more than most of our listeners combined. Do you find the testimony to be hopelessly contradictory, or full of loose ends that you can't reconcile?
No, not at all. Not at all. We do need to keep in mind that the principles of writing biography and history were somewhat different then than they are today. There was a little bit more flexibility in exactly how you told the story. But when you look at the differences, the differences are minute. They're not different, and certainly by the standards that were used for the genres that existed in terms of ancient biography and ancient historiography, those differences are much less than what you normally expect. And I've also tried an experiment, because my wife is from Congo. She was a war refugee there, and we are writing up her story right now. And so I'm taking her notes. She kept a journal during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm comparing what I've gotten from her orally with her journal, and just seeing some of the, well, here a particular discrepancy seems to come up. I go back and I check with her, because I have her available as an eyewitness. And the discrepancy is usually easily reconciled based on more knowledge that I just didn't have in both of the sources. Sometimes I think we just don't have the fullest information that would enable us to reconcile some of the apparent discrepancies.
So the idea that several people witnessing the same accident might describe it differently, that can actually apply in the gospel accounts as well?
Yes, of course.
What about the different perspectives, though, that the writers bring? Are they all talking about the same historical Jesus? Are none of them creating an image about him that's not true?
Biographers and historians often would state up front that they had certain perspectives that they wanted to get across. Nobody in the ancient world expected them not to do that. They would have certain political agendas, certain moral agendas. Sometimes, as in the case of Josephus, they would have theological agendas as well. But saying that somebody has an agenda doesn't mean that they're making up the information that they're using to support that agenda. And it also doesn't mean you can have agendas that are complementary without being conflicting. So, you know, we're not saying on the theological level this one's right and this one's wrong. But certainly on the level of information, we don't have to say that because somebody is writing from a perspective that their information is wrong.
All right, so it could be like you're writing about the athlete, you're writing about the man, you're writing about when the person became a political leader, someone as multifaceted as Jesus, the Son of God. It takes a lot of biographies to cover. Hey, we come back. Let's talk about the miracles. I mean, come on, Craig. You're a thinking man. Certainly, we can't take the miracle accounts seriously, let alone the resurrection. We'll take this up when we come back.
Fire
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown here with my special guest, Professor Craig Keener, author most recently of The Historical Jesus of the Gospels. We're talking about the historicity of the Gospels, the trustworthiness of the Gospels, that they convey a reliable picture to us of this historical figure that we know as Jesus, Yeshua. If you've got a question, especially if you're a skeptic, I'll try to take a couple of calls over the course of the show, 866-34-TRUTH. If you go to AskDrBrown.org, click on Line of Fire, there is a link to Craig's book, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels. Craig, before we get into the question of miracles, let me ask you one other question. I debated a Reform rabbi, very skeptical, last September, and he railed against the possibility of knowing about a historical Jesus, and then said, look, all the pagan parallels and the virgin birth parallels and dying and rising God parallels, and then he quoted Mithra, and, you know, Mithra's, is everything's borrowed from Mithraism, etc. Of course you laugh as a historian and historical scholar. Yeah. Why laughing at that? Not as a person of faith here, but as a matter of scholarship.
Well, the so-called virgin birth parallels, I mean, most of the parallels you have in paganism, you have lots of different deities, and most of the male deities, like the people who worshipped them, were promiscuous, and so they went around and impregnated women. But this was hardly a virgin birth.
Right.
Or virgin conception. It's an utterly different idea. And then in terms of dying and rising gods, this is not the... I mean, with Jesus' resurrection, we're talking about the Jewish conception of the resurrection of the dead, the bodily resurrection of the dead at the end of the age. These dying and rising gods, most of what you have are myths, not an account, an eyewitness account from many living eyewitnesses within a generation. You have myths about ancient figures, and they're associated with the rejuvenation of the seasons every spring. It's very different from the Jewish conception of the resurrection of the dead, which is the conception on which the Gospels clearly draw. I mean, it's the language that they clearly use.
Mm. What about all the so-called parallels with Mithra? I mean, that's got to convince, that's got to stir up some doubt with you, Craig.
No. Mithraism wasn't even popular in the Roman Empire until a couple centuries later. So the idea of Mithraism influencing early Christianity, I mean, later on, a few centuries later, you have some influence from various sources, probably including Mithraism, on later Christianity, and vice versa. Some of the so-called parallels we find in the mystery religions and so on actually were borrowed from Christianity, but that's much later. What we have in the earliest sources, there's no evidence for that.
All right, so if someone finds in a speech an exact phrase, George Washington said it, Ronald Reagan said it, Reagan could have been quoting Washington, but Washington couldn't have been quoting Reagan.
That's true.
All right, but let's get back to this miracle thing. Look, obviously miracles don't happen today. I mean, we know that people aren't being healed and blind eyes opening today, so they're not happening today. Why in the world should we believe that they happened, you know, in Jesus' day?
Well, what you're repeating is an argument from analogy that has been popular, especially since the time of David Hume, who was a philosopher who said that, well, we don't see miracles today, and therefore there's no reason to believe that miracles ever happened in the past. And in fact, what he had to do, there were some people in his day who had claimed to see miracles, and he explained that away. And then in some other parts of the world, he said those are ignorant and barbarous people. He actually was an ethnocentric racist, supported slavery and so on as well. But anyway, that's another story. The argument from analogy actually should cut the other direction. We have, there was a Pew study done, I believe, in 2008. It was done as a survey of Pentecostals and Charismatics, and it gives a survey from 10 countries of the Pentecostals and Charismatics, and the numbers of those who have claimed to experience or witness divine healing. And the total number comes out to about 200 million. And then if you look at the survey also covers other Christians who don't claim to be Pentecostals or Charismatics. And it's something like one quarter to one third of those in these countries that were surveyed also claim to have experienced or witnessed divine healing. Now, if you want to take David Hume's argument and say, well, we know that miracles couldn't happen then because we know that, that no credible witness happens to say that they happen today, you can't just dismiss that many witnesses. You're going to have to go look at some of the evidence. And I started gathering some of the evidence originally for a footnote, but it's grown into a book that's longer than Historical Jesus of the Gospels.
Are you serious?
Yeah, which should be a sequel to it. Maybe a year or more before this one is out, but I have I just have some wonderful stories. Would it be all right if I told a couple of them?
Oh, sure. Go for it, please.
All right. One is from my colleague, Emmanuel Atopson. He teaches Hebrew Bible here. He has a PhD from Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. He grew up in Nigeria. He's Nigerian, and his father was doing evangelism in this one village. Back around 1975, and probably most of the people there were not Christians at the time, and he was putting a roof on his house, and they all started laughing at him because it was rainy season. They knew rainy season, they knew it was going to rain, and they said, you know, you're going to lose everything, and he got mad. He said, he still had 4 days left to work on the house. He said, for these next 4 days until this roof is on, it's not going to rain in this village. And then they went away laughing, and he fell on his face before God and said, oh, God, what have I done? God, please, for the sake of the honor of your name in this village, for the next 4 days, rain poured down all around the village, but not a single drop fell on the village until his roof was on. Mm. And at the end of those 4 days, there was only one person in the village who remained a non-Christian.
Wow.
And in that village to this day, they still talk about, they don't see it as a coincidence. They know rainy seasons. They know their climate and their culture.
Mm.
They changed religions that had been held for generations because they saw a miracle. This is something you can't attribute to psychosomatic causes. You know, mm-hmm. rain doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give another one?
Yeah, sure. We got about a minute and a half. Go for it.
Okay. In Congo, there was a woman whose 2-year-old daughter died. She stopped breathing. There was no hospitals. There was nothing available in the village. She strapped the baby to her back, ran for about 3 hours until she got to the village where an evangelist was that they knew, that was a friend of the family, prayed for the girl. She started breathing again. She'd been dead for 3 hours. She started breathing again. By the next day, she
was... Wait, so... Yeah, somehow we just lost you there, Craig. You still there?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay, we just lost you. Yeah, so the baby started breathing again after 3 hours.
And the next day, the baby was fine. And then we know that the baby didn't suffer brain damage because the baby now has grown up. This is my sister-in-law, Therese.
Oh, really?
Magnuha. And the mother is my mother-in-law. I interviewed
wow.
my mother-in-law. You know, we've known it in the family. The evangelist who prayed for her, we interviewed him too. I mean, it's
amazing.
All there.
So, bottom line, you can have scholarship and you can believe God because the two go hand in hand when done properly. All right, we'll be back. We'll focus on the resurrection of Jesus when we come back on The Line of Fire. Welcome back to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown with my special guest, Professor Craig Keener, talking about the historical reliability of the Gospels. His most recent book, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels, 831 pages, published by Erdmans. Wonderfully, clearly written, phenomenally well documented, as all of Professor Keener's works are. Get a copy of it, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels. If you go to our website, askdrbrown.org, and click on The Line of Fire, there is a link to his book that you can order. Craig, bottom line, if Jesus rose from the dead, we better pay attention to what he had to say and do. If he didn't, boy, a lot of nice teaching, but that's the end of it. How can we be so sure, aside from a matter of faith and experience, that Jesus rose from the dead? What are some of the historical arguments on behalf of the resurrection?
Whenever we're dealing with history, we're dealing with eyewitness claims. So sort. Well, sometimes we don't have eyewitness claims. Sometimes we have much further removed claims. In the case of the resurrection of Jesus, we have an abundance of eyewitness evidence. We don't have just a single source. We have multiple sources. We have them being written actually within the first generation. Paul's writings come much earlier than some of the other testimony. Paul attests that up to 500 saw Jesus alive on one occasion and says that most are alive to this day, which seems to be an invitation. If you don't believe me, just go check them out. They're still available. And that Jesus was seen on multiple occasions. None of this fits hallucination. There were lots of people back then who believed in ghosts, but for ghosts, you don't use the language of resurrection. For a mere apparition, for something that's not bodily, you don't use the language of resurrection, and don't have also accounts of people touching him and eating with him and so on.
But look, they wanted to believe this, Craig. I mean, this was their whole faith riding on it. Surely there's some kind of cognitive dissonance or something where they went into denial, and maybe that contributed to the hallucination.
All of them? You don't have any detractors. And you would expect, you know, if one person had been a detractor, if one of the witnesses had said, oops, I was wrong, just one, it would have been enough for their enemies to have pounced all over that. They would have had to have responded to it. But we don't have anything of that sort. And for that matter, there are a lot of people that we love who have passed away. We would be sure very happy to say that they're risen from the dead, too. And yet I don't know a whole lot of people who go around saying that is the case.
The fact that they then preach this message and were willing to die for it, what does that indicate in terms of their psychological state?
They were very convinced. I had a friend who objected, you know, people die for things that aren't true all the time. Well, that's true. But normally when you die for something, it at least means you believe it's true. They weren't just dying for the belief that Jesus rose from the dead. They were dying for the belief that they had seen him alive from the dead, which takes it to a completely different level.
And you're saying that we don't have other ancient documents disputing this. What about the other gospels, the Gnostic gospels, and these others that are getting such play these days? What do they tell us?
Those sources are much later. The earliest of those sources is by the common dating, Gospel of Thomas. By the common dating is about 70 years after the Gospel of Mark, and by the common dating of the Gospel of Mark. And recently, another scholar has dated that even a generation later than that, and has given some fairly strong evidence for that. Also, the other Gospels that people appeal to are much later than that. Now, you have apocryphal Gospels, which are basically just novels, but the Gnostic Gospels are mainly sayings collections. They are all written much later than living memory of the eyewitnesses. And some of them, you have one thing called the Secret Gospel of Mark, which some people were using and saying, this is earlier than the canonical Gospels accepted by the Church. And recently, a couple books independently, one from, I believe, Baylor University Press, one from Yale University Press, have independently argued that this is a forgery from the 20th century, mm-hmm. and again, given very convincing evidence for that.
Right, so we simply don't have other ancient records denying the resurrection. You have all of these multiple attestations of people that were the eyewitnesses or claimed to know the eyewitnesses, and these people were willing to die, not just for the belief that Jesus rose, but saying they actually saw him. Hey, really quickly, 15 seconds, are any of the Gospels written by eyewitnesses, do you think?
Yes. In fact, the Gospel of John claims to rest on eyewitness evidence. The Gospel of Luke claims to have interviewed eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Many scholars think that the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Matthew either is eyewitness or depends on eyewitness material.
Got it. All right. Thanks. Hey, when we come back, our last segment, let's talk about who this Jesus really is. We'll be back with Professor Craig Keener. Welcome back to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us. My special guest this whole hour, Professor Craig Keener. Hey, just a reminder, this Thursday, so 2 days from today, I will be interviewing Pastor Martin Sempa from Uganda about the Ugandan bill called the Anti-Homosexuality Bill. Does this bill actually call for the killing of homosexuals? That is 2 days from today here on the Line of Fire. Craig, I know how busy you are. I really appreciate you taking time out to talk with our listeners. You've been studying the scriptures now for many, many years. First, as a believer without the academic training and background, now as someone, you plunged into the original sources, you've read them in multiple languages. Would you say that your faith is stronger now through all your studies, or has it been weakened through all the academic studies?
No, it's much stronger now than it was. Now, there was a time when I was in the midst of it, when some of the challenges were really, I wasn't sure how to answer all the questions, but that's the way I think it is with any kind of testing that we go through.
Mm-hmm.
That the test, if we persevere, the test ultimately strengthens our faith, and ultimately, in this case, those tests encouraged me to find answers.
So you weren't just going to try to find an answer to prop your faith up. You wanted truth.
I wanted truth. That's why I turned to Christ to begin with, was because I had been thinking I was following truth, and then when Christ revealed himself to me, I realized I had been following falsehood.
Mm. Craig's latest book, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels, we've got it linked on our website. Get a copy of it. All right, Craig, in the last few minutes that we have, you're a teacher, you're a professor. You are not a traveling evangelist and preacher. But I would just love for you, as a teacher of the Word of God, to take a couple minutes and just talk to us about who this Jesus really is, who you've come to know him to be through the Word and your own walk with him.
One thing I found, to connect the academic and the personal, one thing I found was that when I was examining the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, there's a clear connection between that and the unanimous understanding of the first century church that Jesus is the risen Lord. That is, the same Jesus who was in the Gospels, the same Jesus who spoke to his disciples then, is the same Jesus whom God the Father raised from the dead and enthroned at his own right hand, the same Jesus who sent the Spirit, the same Jesus that we have a personal relationship with. It's not like there's a disconnect between the Gospels and the Epistles.
Mm.
I was, I think it was 17, when I was first, I just developed this passion in my heart. I wanted to hear God's voice so much, and he just sparked faith in my heart that he would speak to me if I asked him. And so I asked him, and the voice that I began to hear in prayer, the relationship that I began to have with him was so deep and so wonderful. I realized that there's no way anybody could know what Jesus is really like and not fall madly in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most people who don't love him, it's because they just don't know what he's really like.
You know, just what you said, I've read a lot of what you've written, and you've written many, many, many thousands of pages, but boy, does that sum up what your whole life is about in one little phrase? If you really came to know who Jesus was, you have to fall madly in love with him. Friends, can I ask you to be in prayer for Craig Keener and his family? He's on the front lines in ways that many of us are not. Pray that God's blessing, strength, power, favor would rest on him and his family, and that God would hear the cries of their hearts as they stand for truth. Craig, again, thank you, sir, for being with us. I deeply appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I'm so grateful to be with you, Michael.
All right. God bless. All right, friends, if you're in the greater Charlotte area, join me tonight at Charlotte 1. Otherwise, we'll be back with you tomorrow here on the Line of Fire.